statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
The fact that every politician respects voters, and we have enough Carter City voting power here.
Big Vince.
To change anything that needs to be changed.
Politics, progress, game boards, objects, viewed like pawns to be change up our mindset. Value of the dollars at the center of this conflict, but lives only matter if they serve to make a profit. But if a midget sees further on the shoulders of the giant, then we should see further than the tyrant and build a future within alliance where success is our science in the quest to go higher. It's the heart of the city.
Wake up, world. You are listening to the Heart of the City. Happy Wednesday. I'm your host, Malik Boyd. I hope that wherever you are, you are in good spirits and all is truly well. The show topic today, power of the pen. We're talking about healing, learning, and loving through literary works. I think that's one particular area, at least in my personal opinion, that we do not focus in and on in our conversations as it relates to how we heal. There are quite a few authors that we follow, but there is so much more to explore, not only just as a culture, but as a country. And I think the literary area is where we will be able to get out our thoughts, our perspectives, and also help to change some of the climate that has become quite challenging over the last couple years. It is our books that will translate, I believe, history properly. How we write down our message will be here long after Facebook, long after, I think at times we were posting on MySpace at one point. I don't think anybody even travels to MySpace anymore. During my years, there was AOL and Black Planet and some of these other places to explore. They fade away because we do not own them. It does not allow us a place to really hold and harness our thoughts, our perspectives, and our history. But it is the literary works that will allow us to gain that perspective and sustain it for time to come. I was not with you guys last week. I appreciate all of the thoughts and calls, the emails, but we've had some challenging times over the last couple of weeks. The country is still in an uproar. I mean, we just had a president decide that he is going to restructure how we celebrate sports teams, and it is going to be at his discretion and not at the country's celebration of those sports teams. And so the Philadelphia Eagles were disinvited to 1600 Pennsylvania. And I will not say to his house. I saw some post that said, you know, well, he kicked them out of his house, or why would you want to go to his house? Guys, it's not his house. It is actually on loan from the people to the office of the presidency. And so I need that everyone to kind of understand that and be clear. That is not his location. That is our location. And I do think, and I had some conversation online. You can catch us on Facebook and kind of see that dialogue, on even my personal page, how some believed that he was justified in his ability, to talk about patriotism and what that looks like and how it should be done. My challenge with that was, well, first, I said it's absolutely okay. He can say whatever he desires to say, because I think that is his perspective, and First Amendment allows for perspective to be given. But if you are going to reprogram a celebration of a sports team and you're going to make it a patriotic celebration, which included military and choirs and flags all over the place, and that, I mean, we just got to be honest. I do believe that he played a role in setting up what that rally looked like. At the very least, if you are going to prove your point on patriotism, you might want to remember the words to songs like God Bless America. I'm just saying. I think if you're going to call someone else unpatriotic, at the very least, you should know all the words to the songs that you're going to sing in your rally. That did not happen. And quite frankly, Fox News, which some will believe to be a pure supporter of the president, was actually one of the key cameras that zoomed in on the president as he stumbled through the words to God Bless America. Someone actually transcribed it, and it was not pretty. Lance is even shaking his head right now. I mean, this is a sad state of affairs where our country is going tit for tat on the atrocities that we're dealing with. And quite frankly, you know, it was never about taking a knee to disrespect the flag. It was taking a knee to lend a voice to those who will never be able to raise their voice again because they were killed at the hands of improper procedure or whatever kind of narrative was going to be used to make sure that that police officer or whoever committed that crime would be able to get away and not be charged. And that's a pure fact. The videos did not lie. The eyewitness accounts did not lie. But justice was not served in many cases. I will say, and I've been a critic of the rebuild program here in Philadelphia, but I will actually give honor where honor is due. Mayor Jim Kenney from the city of Philadelphia had a tremendous interview, I believe, on MSNBC, where he talked about the fact that he was a privileged white man. He embraced the fact that he was privileged and that the kind of experiences that we have as African Americans and those that are in the minority population, he does not experience and doesn't quite frankly even relate to it because it's not a part of his journey. And he placed himself in the privileged white class, which is unique to see in this time where everyone's throwing blame. I respect that. I honor that. And in the midst of everything that is going on, he did talk about the fact that there are many of color who do not have the same rights or experiences that others do in this country. And it's time to go beyond the conversation to a conclusion that works for all. In the midst of that, we still have conversations around violence. We still have conversations around how we protect our children in school. We have conversations around our young children and their education, how that is going to be funded. All of these things are daily ongoing dialogues that at some point we're going to have to address each and take them to a solution. You know, we always address solutions and make that our focal point here at Heart of the City, but we also start the show off in prayer. And so to that end, I'm going to take us into our 2-minute prayer for the city. Heavenly Father, we come before you just to say thank you for another day of life on this experience we call Earth. What the challenges are, you already know. What the issues are, you already have solutions for. And so we come to you now asking you to guide us to those solutions. We recognize that we cannot legislate our way out of the challenges of the day. It's a heart issue. And unless the heart is changed, it doesn't matter who we remove from office. It doesn't matter what laws we put in place. The activities that divide us and keep us away from being united will continue to exist. There will always be a loophole when someone looks to do something that is outside of your design. And so we ask you to remove that spirit from our hearts. Allow us to be able to listen to each other. Communication is so important in today's time. Everyone has a story. Not everyone is able to tell their story, and certainly audiences have closed their ears to certain stories from certain people, but you've made us all no matter our experience, no matter our challenge, no matter our race, no matter our creed, no matter our education, no matter our social status, we all belong to you. Remind us of that now. Bless those who are listening. Bless those who are away from this broadcast. Cover us all and give us what we need to move forward within your design and bring progress, not just to our people, but to this nation and to this world as we know it. And we'll be careful to give your name the honor and praise now and forever. Amen. So I'm going to a break. The show Power of the Pen. On the other side, we have State Representative Morgan Cephas. She'll break down what's happening in Harrisburg. We'll also hear from three prolific authors, Jonathan Cameron, Helen Irwin, and Bridget Martin Holmes. That's all on the other side. I promise you, you do not want to miss this. Take out your stethoscope. Place it on a radio dial. You're listening to The Heart of the City.
Hi, this is Malik Boyd, the host of the Heart of the City radio show. Have you been injured at work? Work injuries create a great deal of stress and financial hardship for the entire family. Uniting the City, Easy Scripts is a national home delivery pharmacy service helping injured workers with all of their medication and medical equipment needs. They remove the problems injured workers have filling their prescriptions. And with their free home delivery and no out-of-pocket expenses for medications, Uniting the City Easy Scripts makes it easier for injured workers to focus on getting better and taking care of their families. Enrollment is quick and easy. Call a Uniting the City Easy Scripts customer care specialist today and let them take this burden off your shoulders. The call is free. 855-729-3939. That's 855-729-3939. 3939. Paid for by Easy Scripts Pharmacy.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that, overall, you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't seen your lap in months. And even more stuff. But still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed. And they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs. And it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff. Create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
We're back. You're listening to The Heart of the City. The show topic today, the power of the pen. Healing, learning, and loving through literary works. We have three amazing writers ahead that you'll hear from them. And we'll talk about their books. We'll talk about their passion and impact. And more importantly, how we can move the conversations of the day forward through the turning of the pages. Before I get to that in our EKG, I want to talk to State Representative Morgan Cephas. This is her segment on the House. As you know, we bring her in once a month to talk about everything that is happening in the halls of Harrisburg, as it relates to the Philadelphia and PA legislature. And there's tons of stuff going on.
So there is tons of stuff.
Morgan, it's an absolute pleasure to have you back on Heart of the City.
No, I appreciate you guys. And there's always so much going on. I feel like a 2-minute segment just never allows me to get it all in.
We need like a 20-minute segment just to get through
half of the
issues of the day. Now I know you're up in Harrisburg working hard. It's the top of the week. There's votes flying all over the place, caucus meetings happening. But let the listening audience know what needs to be on our radar and what we need to pay attention to.
So we have a couple of things. We have three things that hit as a top priority issue for us right now. Of course, we are in budget season, so we'll be up here on a weekly basis in the month of June trying to, you know, hash out some of the budget issues that we might have. I know, you know, last year we had, you know, a big stall. We were, you know, competing interests. A series of taxes were being proposed that would have had a detrimental effect to our economy in Philadelphia. Given that it's election season, it hasn't been too much back and forth.
Imagine that.
We're hearing that. I know, right? I think something might be in the air that might, you know, mediate that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think we're supposed to have a pretty calm budget season, not too much back and forth, and we actually might get out of here on time. I think that's actually the governor's first budget that he'll get in on time. Yeah.
Wow.
Believe it or not. But two other issues that really should be on our radar. One is a Senate bill in reference to safe harbor legislation for our young girls. It deals with an issue of human trafficking, which is essentially sex trafficking, prostitution to some people. And a lot of our young people, you know, even in, you know, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, across the country, are being sex trafficked, you know, against their will by predators. And, you know, a lot of people don't associate this type of activity with our Commonwealth or even with our country just because, you know, we're first-class country. We're not a third-world country. And it's really happening at home. And believe it or not, it could very well be happening in some of our neighborhoods if we just look carefully. So in the state of Pennsylvania, we've had 273 cases reported just in 2016 alone.
Yeah.
And it's close to over 100,000 kids throughout the country that are being sex trafficked. And it's the fast and growing criminal enterprise that we're experiencing here in the state. So, you know, this bill comes at a perfect time. I am, again, the chair of the Women and Girls of Color Subcommittee for the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus. So this has been, you know, a priority of ours. My colleague, Joanna McClinton, has been a really big champion of this. And, you know, one of the organizations that I'm a part of, Links Incorporated, it too has bubbled up as one of our priorities. So we're really paying attention to this legislation. This provides for our young people that are victims of human trafficking to not be prosecuted. So when we talk about that school to prison pipeline or just a pipeline into our criminal justice system, this diverts our young people into the right hands. So the Department of Human Services will be required to, you know, coordinate different services and resources on the local level to, you know, really, again, divert our young people to services and essential resources that are needed to, you know, get them out of the hands of predators.
Now, is that also a component that will be placed inside of the existing budget that we have? Or is this something that we have to have conversations for around raising the resources to ensure that we can take care of these victims?
Oh yeah, of course. In our DHS line item, we're constantly asking for increases to, again, address, you know, situations like these. But this is a standalone bill that came over from the Senate, went into the House, just got out of our Judiciary Committee over on the House side, and is now on the floor for our now on the floor of the House to be voted on or to be amended. So, you know, at this point, we really got to make a rally cry to pressure our elected officials. And the great thing, not that it's great, but it is actually great. It's a bipartisan bill. It's a Republican, the chair of Judiciary over on the Senate side, and our Democratic Senator Dalen Leach is also a co-lead sponsor. So it's a bipartisan effort. And I feel like it just reinforces that the importance should be on these victims. We shouldn't be, you know, making them criminals. We should be looking at them as, again, victims as what they are.
So it's really interesting because there are significant cases throughout the state, and they've gone largely under the radar. I mean, we talk about the shootings that happen inside of the inner cities, and they have merit in their own right as being triage issues. But this issue, I mean, everyone, and I won't say everyone, but the majority of the news outlets don't cover it. But it's growing, as you said earlier. Yeah. And so what are some of the things that we can do inside of our communities to be vigilant around protecting our young children?
I think being a watchful eye, when you see, you know, making sure that you look out if you see some young people loitering in, you know, an awkward location, interacting with, you know, adults that, you know, are possibly, you know, just driving by in their car, mm-hmm. and, you know, talking to the young person and it seems kind of odd, or you can look for, you know, potentially an overseer that's, you know, kind of coming to the young people, but making sure that they're not being left. They're sitting in a car kind of waiting for those type of interactions.
Yeah.
Or if you look for, you know, a property that's in your neighborhood where you just see a constant amount of young people coming to and from, and again, you have that overseer, I think that potentially raises the red flag. So you definitely want to, you know, report them to the authorities, but also we want to raise our voices through, you know, op-ed opportunities, through the media, hosting press conferences, calling your state legislator to, you know, let them know that this is a priority for mm-hmm. you in your community.
And I definitely want to say, too, you know, there are subtle changes in behaviors that you definitely want to pay attention to and continue to talk to mm-hmm. youth and those who are vulnerable to this kind of incident. You'll see even sometimes children or young girls, they're going from, you know, dressing mm-hmm. in a normal fashion to now, you know, mm-hmm. wearing sweatshirts and putting a hood over their head where normally they would mm-hmm. never do that. Those are conversation points, in times where we should be alerted, and kind of dig a little bit, not in an intrusive way, but let them know that they're loved and begin some kind of conversations that hope mm-hmm. to create platforms.
Yeah. So we're also dealing with up here is, a lot of preemption measures. So, you know, mm-hmm. in the city of Philadelphia, we have the soda tax issue, which is still being challenged in our court system, so mm-hmm. we're looking to get some type of ruling in the near future about that. But we have our Republican counterparts up here. Well, not all of them, because some of the Southeastern Republicans are not in support of preemption.
Okay.
But we have one of our Republican colleagues interested in preempting the city's ability to impose this tax on this type of product.
Hmm.
And we're going back and forth. Again, this is the soda industry really lobbying to get this preemption passed. And this could potentially be, because it's not going to see any light of the day on the House floor, because it's just too controversial. Because once, again, you're not just preempting Philadelphia, but you're preempting those western counties as well that won't be able to impose taxes that will help cover some of the gap funding that they need for schools or for recreation centers and things like that. So that could potentially be a bill that might get implemented into our fiscal code, which is something that we have to watch out for.
Wow. So there's a lot going on, not just
on
the funding side, but a lot of environmental challenges that we have just to ensure the safety of our children and the well-being of our mm-hmm. community. You know, while Morgan and the crew are fighting to ensure that the resources come in, as Representative Cephas said, there are things that we can do at home to make mm-hmm. sure that we get into a preemptive kind of mindset to ensure that we don't have as many victims, because we're able to kind of catch this thing before it gets started and ensure that we don't have trauma continuously impacting our community. So, Rep, it's going to be a busy summer.
It is.
Hopefully a budget that is balanced and comfortable and suitable for at least the majority of some of the things that, you know, we can all agree on. But what's your legislative focus or community focus for the summer? What are some of the things that we, should be looking out of the office of Representative Cephas?
So, of course, we are going to host our annual, district day. Mm-hmm. We'll have a second annual district. This is our second one. We don't have the artist just yet, but we're floating some names. So that's going to be pretty exciting. And it's just a day for our constituents to come out, connect with us, but also have a good time. Get some resources from the series of resource tables that we'll have out there. We'll also, we added a couple of elements to it. So we'll have a kid zone where kids can just be kids for a day with a game truck, a racetrack, moon bounces. But then we'll also have a senior pavilion where seniors will be able to, again, connect the resources. Mm-hmm. But on the musical end, we're going to try to get our kids, you know, and the public more interested in, you know, college opportunities as well as music. So we're going to do a battle of the bands with some of the local bands and drill teams that exist in our community. And then we're also going to do a step show where we feature some of my my counterparts in Greekdom. So it won't just be Delta.
There you go.
So it'll be a really good time. That's scheduled for August 18th. I know we're a little ways away, but, you know, I'll be advertising it every month. It'll be from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. We also are doing a big push around a piece with agriculture. There are these fruits and vegetable vouchers that our seniors and our WIC recipients, that's women with infant children, mm-hmm. are eligible for. So seniors, they are redeeming their vouchers, a $20 voucher. They're redeeming it at an 85% redemption rate. Wow. But on the WIC side, where we have our single mothers taking care of young kids, it's less than 50%. So we really want to, you know, make a concerted effort to connect possibly our daycare centers where women or fathers are using CIS mm-hmm. benefits to fund that daycare opportunity. But then if they are eligible for the CIS, they should be eligible for this voucher. So we want to see how we can make some connection there to, you know, really get those numbers up.
I think that's extremely important, and I'm glad that you are delving into the agricultural side. And I think a lot of times inner city representatives are expected to kind of stay, you know, just in what we perceive to be urban issues, not understanding how much agriculture plays a role.
Agriculture is huge.
Yeah.
I always get, why is an urban girl sitting on ag? And I try to explain to people that majority of our policies are driven from a production standpoint.
Absolutely.
Whereas we're not really incorporating the consumer. And when you look at cities like Pittsburgh and cities like Philadelphia, we're the consumer base. So shouldn't we be kind of tailoring agricultural activities and policies to allow us to consume more, especially from the Commonwealth? So
absolutely.
It's an entire ecosystem that, you know, we really need to be working on. So that's why Urban Girl sits on that. And it's the number one industry in the state of Pennsylvania.
It is the number one industry and one that we can play a role in our inner cities. Those gardens and some of those opportunities that we have inside of our neighborhoods are equally important.
With the urban gardens, we need to really support them, especially when, you know, certain areas in the city of Philadelphia don't have development opportunities. We can, you know, turn them into food opportunities.
Absolutely.
Since we have a lot of food deserts. Yes.
Absolutely. So you've heard it from Representative Cephas. She's got her hands in agriculture. She's fighting for the rights of those who are vulnerable to trafficking and some of the issues that we are seeing becoming more prevalent in the state of PA. She's sitting in the midst of the budget battle, ensuring that resources come home to take care of the programs and those who need it most. We're absolutely excited to have Representative Cephas on our behalf, not just from Heart of the City to give perspective, but for the great city of Philadelphia to be one of our key representatives and making things happen. Thank you so much for doing what you do, and we will continue to be a strong supporter of you and your efforts.
Thank you. Thanks for always having me.
And listen, if you don't find any music artists, I do beatbox and DJ on Friday nights. I got you.
We'll take it. No doubt.
Take care, right. Rep. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Brett, let's go to the EKG. This is the EKG, the part of the show where we place the country, America, as we know it, on the radio dial. We'll monitor the heart of the issues and look for any irregularities in America's heartbeat. Now, we'll offer basic solutions and even surgery in some of the cases that we find in hopes that we can remove blockages and help America, as we know it, become healthy once again. So, Brett, fire up the machine. And let's start the EKG. I have TML sitting next to me. Teresa, it's good to see you back.
It's good to see you here.
In the studio. So now, Washington Post, they report a teen killed with a... This is crazy. I mean, a young teen kills a black man with a truck and then goes online and begins to call him racial slurs.
Was the teen... You got to give us a little bit more context. So was the teen Caucasian?
By golly, you're just so intuitive.
I just
oh my goodness.
The Heart City viewers want to know
what's
going on. Heart
City. Yes, absolutely. So Sherelle Lewis Jr. Was never really big on birthdays, at least as the Washington Post reports this. His latest, though, came this past Tuesday, and there were no plans to celebrate beyond a visit that he was trying to have with his family in Leeville, Louisiana. Now, he went through, I guess, his normal routine of you know, receiving birthday cards and calling, and he talked to his mother, and his mother said, you know, she would see him, you know, later on in the day. He's 31 on this birthday, and so he was on foot. Helping another driver clear debris from the road. You know, you hit Lincoln Drive. There's a tree. We're going to get out. We're going to help.
Because you can't drive around it.
Because I can't drive around it, right? Plus, I'm being a good Samaritan, right? So if I see, you know, someone who needs aid, I'm going to be supportive of that. And so he was just following that mantra when he was struck by a pickup truck. And this is reports from the police. Now, a passerby found his phone. Because he was hit pretty hard, and called his father. I'm assuming that his father was probably in the call log due to his birthday. Now, his mother rushed frantically to the scene. Authorities kept her away. This is one of the most heartbreaking lines that I've read this past week. The last words she would hear her son say, as the authorities blocked her from getting to her son, was, "Mama, mama, mama, I want my mama." Mm,
at 31. Yeah.
This is how he passes. And I'm still kind of challenged around that. Like, if my child is dying on the road, let me be there. Let me at least be in some kind of proximity where my child can see me present, right? And then if my child is calling for me, I don't know. And I know you're not trying to taint crime scenes, and I get all that, but my child's calling for me. That's the very least that we can do is get her closer, to her son. Now, he was pronounced dead at Byrd Regional Hospital in Leeville. Now, shortly thereafter, because, you know, this becomes a major issue throughout the area, the driver is on Snapchat. And, his name, Matthew Martin, he's 18 years old. He's on Snapchat saying that he had hit some N-word on the highway.
And then what?
So somebody actually, now here's the crazy thing. Somebody didn't even flag it initially. They asked him, well,
are you okay?
Not are you okay? How did your pickup handle everything? Yeah, how's the car?
Wow. And he was 18, so the driver was 18.
So even if you lock him up, I mean, we still got issues with people whose mindsets say, my friend just hit someone, and rather than admonishing them and trying to deal with this issue of them particularly committing vehicular homicide, I'm going to ask you, you didn't break any taillights or headlights or anything. You didn't dent your car, did you?
I think it's disturbing. And it's, finish. Before I give my full thought.
So here's the thing. So Kevin G, who has served in law enforcement and security, he's on our Facebook live stream. He says, you can't contaminate the scene, so it's hard. I had to do that, and it's not a good feeling. I totally understand. And that's the challenge, right? So you're trying not to contaminate the scene, but this child is on his last breath. And we're all not medical doctors. I wasn't, you know, at the scene, so I can't, you know, ascertain at the moment, which you kind of understood that to be the case. But you have a mother in tremendous amount of pain along with her child who is dying on the road. And then you got a guy on Snapchat basically celebrating that he hit.
So I think it's two separate issues we're talking about in this article. One mm-hmm. is the heartstring with the mother and the son and the last words of that. Mm-hmm. And the second piece is Snapchat's responsibility and why it wasn't flagged and the other issues that we have with social media today.
So you know, they're trying to dig through whether or not Snapchat really was made aware and moved through it, right? Okay. And so obviously, you know, I do believe that there should be some kind of filters. There should at least be hate speech filters.
Absolutely.
Right? So
absolutely.
Whether it's Facebook, Instagram, whatever, the moment a word that is designated a hate mm-hmm. speech kind of word, the moment you type that, there should be some kind of flag that should go into an overall system.
Right.
Right? That's just my opinion. But I think it's one that could be easily implemented. But again, it goes back to heart issues. I mean, so another person, so this guy said, you know, in response to whether or not his car got messed up, he used a curse word and said, you know, I it up mm-hmm. real good, right? So there's clearly no remorse there. He's talking nope. about his car, and so he's having conversation with another individual who's totally talking about his car too, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Then another person chimes in and says, well, you could probably buff it out.
This is a long conversation on Snapchat. So,
listen,
like,
I'm floored. I mean, you can buff that out. You can buff out
the N word.
Come on.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and then they ask, after we deal with the car issues, whether or not we have to go to R&S Strauss or AutoZone and pick up some pieces. After we deal with that, then they decided to ask, well, was he killed?
What was his answer? He signed off.
He used a laughing emoji and said that the man died on the way to the hospital.
All right, so now, third piece of the situation, mm-hmm. is he going to be charged as an adult? Should be.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. So whenever you have that level of disdain, of whenever you mm-hmm. have that cold of an heart, mm-hmm. right? Since you decide to be that grown about your business, mm-hmm. I think you should get the business.
Absolutely.
As a grown man. That's
and he's proven swimming. That he was very knowledgeable of the action that he did mm-hmm. and the lack of remorse and responsibility that he wanted to take for another man's life.
Now, here's the crazy part about it. Here's where this gets to become a four piece, right? This is a four piece and a biscuit, right? So Chief Deputy Calvin Turner of the Vernon Parish Sheriff's Office said that all indications lead to Martin's involvement in the social media conversation. Well, duh, he admitted to it.
Yeah.
I don't even know why we're having that kind of conversation. But then they said he's being held and has not been charged yet with the crime.
What county was this in? Was this in, where was this at?
This is Vernon Parish Sheriff's Department. This is in Louisiana. So
Louisiana, okay.
Here's the crazy thing. He says, I am appalled that the content of the social media messages that were posted after the incident, this post is unacceptable and has no place in our society. No. As if we didn't understand that already, right? So, but then he says the post did not violate any Louisiana laws.
Step one of what we need to change.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, so technically he may be correct.
I
do think it's a hate speech when you use that kind of word, right? So he used the word to identify.
But
him.
It might not be a hate speech law or
present right. in Louisiana, right? Some things we got to deal with, right? But then the other side is, isn't it a confession? I mean, isn't that considered a confession?
So I guess
it may not be.
So he didn't even identify the case, and according to that. Was that the full statement?
This is a full statement.
Yeah, so according to the full statement, he didn't even identify the full issue and the consequences that's going to happen, that we're going to prosecute this as an adult. They're still investigating. So he used very...
He was amoebic with the whole thing.
Yeah.
He was amoebic with the whole thing.
Very
so,
safe messaging.
You know, so Snapchat went crazy and they, you know, hashtagged, as we do, you know, Justice Pharrell, which was the hashtag that started trending on social media. But the relatives want his legacy to be more than just a signpost of intolerance. I'm so for that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times we get locked into, you know, let's go ahead and tweet about it. Let's go ahead and do, you know, the social media hashtag, and we're going to take our pictures holding our fists or whatever, right? We saw that with Trayvon. You know, countless people brought sweatshirts. They purchased sweatshirts and helping had Skittles I get it. But what did that do in terms of moving the conversation forward, right? As we talk about stand your ground laws and how we handle those kind of things. And quite frankly, you know, George Zimmerman's went on to do some pretty interesting things and still continues.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And just got finished threatening some other people a few months ago. Right. And so, you know, I so agree with this family. We've got to move beyond this whole social media hype and being bullies on social media. And it's great that we memed Becky, right? For the barbecue. That's nice. I mean, everywhere she goes, we let her know that we're displeased. Okay, but are we dealing with, how do we handle the culture of the climate? The bigger conversation.
Well, again, we have to start utilizing our legislators and putting those laws into place to protect us more, right? So from the social media, from, you know, other laws that are being enacted, or what we see from situations. Essentially, that's how laws actually take place.
They do, by using your voice and calling your representatives. Yes, and it's beyond Snapchat and Twitter and Instagram. You've got to actually have a conversation with the legislator and let them know that you are displeased. And some of those laws that we need to take a look at is how we handle those who call the police erroneously on people of color, like Becky, who decided to, you know, hit the barbecue, and countless others, right? Mm-hmm. So the young woman's sleeping in the dorm. I mean, the list goes on. Malcolm X's granddaughter coming out the Airbnb. I mean, it's
it makes you think that, you know,
ridiculous.
Like when people are placing the calls, their picture just comes up on the screen. Because I'm like, I wonder, you know, if I started to make
So here's
the
thing.
My picture showing up.
If you call, and I may have the number wrong, but if you call, and you keep making erroneous calls, like to the fire department.
Right.
You get fined by the city for making erroneous calls and forcing them to come out for stuff that's inconsequential.
Okay.
I'm like, at the very least, there should be a fine. I mean,
there should be a pattern, because I remember, if we go back to that Starbucks case, I think I don't know if he was a journalist or a blogger, but he could have been one and the same. And he wrote about how many times the management
had called them. Yeah, called
and they were just like, you know, this one was, it was a various amount of cases, like it was racism or just a disturbance. Like, kind of stuff she was calling about was very petty.
Mm-hmm.
And, but again, there was no consequences with those calls.
So no consequences at all.
We need to look into that.
Kevin G ended his comments by saying, hashtag, and I actually agree with this hashtag, this is America. You can see the Donald Glover, Childish Gambino version.
You know, if somebody actually wrote a book about This Is America, I mean, that thing would be endless.
Well, we have countless others. We have Philadelphia Negro. I mean, the souls of black folk. You could just like kind of compile them all together, right? Take the covers off, just add the pages. Let's go to the next EKG, Brett. Another hashtag, biking while black. That's become a new trend, right? So the NAACP and the black motorcyclists are suing Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, for discrimination during, I'm doing air quotes, Black Bike Week, all right? So the NAACP has joined with a couple and another man to sue Myrtle Beach and its police department from what they deem to be discriminatory practices and treatments of thousands of black motorcyclists and enthusiasts who descend on the city for Black Bike Week on Memorial Day weekend. Now, If you didn't know, there are two festivals, motorcycle festivals, that happen in Myrtle Beach during May. Now, the week before, Atlantic Beach Bike Fest, which is dubbed Black Bike Week, the city hosts, you'll love this, title sponsor, Harley Davidson Spring Rally, a.k.a. just Bike Week, right? Which is primarily attended by white motorcycle clubs, those who are considered not known for violence at all.
So same name, just black in front of the...
Black on one, because it's Atlantic Beach Bike Fest, right? And so, and then we have Harley Davidson Spring Rally. That's how you gotta say it. Spring Rally, right? Now, according
I can only imagine the PSAs for that.
Oh, come on. This Sunday.
Right.
Harley. Davidson.
Welcome to the Spring Rally.
Spring Rally.
All right, get on it.
All right, cool. I had to do it. It felt good. So, according to the federal lawsuit, now this is Cedric and Leslie Stevenson of Suwanee, Georgia, and Samuel Jones of Chicago. Myrtle Beach puts this stiff, burdensome kind of approach to how they handle traffic during Black Bike Week versus, you know, the other bike week. Now, they have literally created a, well, let me go back. So, no traffic restrictions in place for Harley Week.
Mm-hmm.
Come as you go. You're free to go down whatever street you want to go down.
Pick up your permit.
Have a ball.
Just drive.
Rock out. Okay. Do your thing, right?
Right.
Black Bike Week.
Uh-oh. Barriers. Walls.
We're
border.
Only keeping you on Kelly Drive. Do not get off. Do not go up Hunting Park. Do not get off on Fox Street. Don't touch Ridge. In fact, when you get to Falls Bridge, make a left and then come down West River Drive.
Drive through the hood.
Go around
Rittenhouse Square.
Going around Rittenhouse Square. Go around the Art Museum and go back on the drive. So basically, they created a motor speedway.
They took out the map. They went to the city commissioner's office and said,
keep
this
rolling.
Is where you're going.
Keep rolling in this circle.
Horrible.
Yeah. So we're going to give you 23 miles for you to just do whatever you want to do.
Horrible.
On that 23 miles, right? Horrible. But you can't go anywhere else in the city. Now, of course, obviously, no one, if you've ever been to any festival that has numbers, you don't want to get caught in a traffic loop.
Right.
No one wants that.
Right.
I don't care what race you are. You just don't want to get caught in the traffic loop. Ironically, that traffic loop was a standard practice for them for Atlantic Bike Fest, Atlantic Beach Bike Fest. Mm. And so, you know, that changed how they went to restaurants, what restaurants were available, what bathrooms are available. Like, the amenities of the city were not open to Black Bike Fest, but because Harley was there, they could do whatever they wanted to do.
And this is at the same location, right?
This is in the same city.
Mm-hmm.
In the same city.
I just wanted to get that clarified.
Oh, yeah. In the same city. Now, what they're saying is, look, you know, in 2014, three people were killed
during
Black Bike Week.
On bikes? Like, were they, or just
well,
in general?
Well, they're not getting, so these were shootings. So I'm assuming unless they're like Sons of Anarchy, you know, this was off bike, right? So whatever incident occurred.
So not funny.
They're now using, city council basically said public safety is a priority. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
We had three shootings during this particular event. The challenge is they cannot confirm that that event
was
even related
right.
to Black Bike Week.
Nor did they even describe what those, where those shootings took place. Was it in a home? Was it at the grocery store?
Listen, we have incidents that happen at big festivals
daily.
All the time,
daily.
Right? And so, you know, you don't just jump into a city council session and go, well, wait a minute, public safety's first concern. We're shutting half of that down.
Well,
it does happen.
Well,
with our
that, that concern from city council actually took place when, mm-hmm. I guess, this case actually arose on their radar. So they're like, wait, now we have an excuse.
There we go. Now we have a legal justification to kind of move forward. And so now the owner of Coastal Sports, this is a business down down there, and he's talking, he interacts with Black Bike Week, and he says, look, there's a general air of lawlessness in the area. What do you think he's talking about?
Black Bike Week.
No!
Oh.
He's actually talking about Harley Week.
Of lawlessness.
There you go.
Okay, okay.
The Highway Patrol is allowed. No, you probably wouldn't have been able to capture that from that, because he says the Highway Patrol is allowing people to cross Highway 17 with open beverages. The Horry County Police are letting people walk up and down Highway 17 with liquor and beer. There's nudity, public urination, public defecation. And the police are just standing in one area letting everyone go by and break the law. But they put us in the traffic loop and tell us keep it moving.
I guess we pose more of a threat. They probably even beefed up the law enforcement during their week as well.
They probably did. The challenge is, you know, is clearly if these reports are true to the articles and to the lawsuit, I mean, it's clearly discriminatory in nature. And, you know, this is a story that we need to follow, because as we talk about our dollars, African Americans who spend a considerable amount of disposable dollars across this economy. When we bring our disposable dollars, at the very least, we should be able to enjoy where we spend our dollars.
That goes from great scholars and our past history, where they say they don't respect the black dollar, nor do we respect ourselves in some instances. But I am glad that the NAACP has joined with the man putting out the lawsuit.
Listen.
And hopefully we can see a resolution and some much needed improvements in that city.
I'm looking forward to it. Lance, we're going to put that on the Facebook page. You'll be able to find that and many more. Stephanie A. Dorsey Cameron, she said, look, it's $1.1 trillion. In black buying power. That's on our Facebook feed now. So we know there's a considerable amount of that at Black Bike Week, right? Being spent to shore up that city's economy. The very least we can do is address how we handle Black Bike Week and making sure that. And first of all, we got to get away from that. It's not Black Bike Week. It's Atlantic Beach Bike Fest. That's the first thing.
Right.
And I think a lot of times we allow the opportunity for the discrimination when we just want to dub it something, right? Let's call it what it is. Atlantic City Bike or Atlantic Beach Bike Fest. There's something about Atlantic City apparently that I keep adding to the mix.
Trying to go there, huh?
Apparently. So, you know, we'll make sure that we follow this and keep this on your radar, and hopefully we get some real resolution to it.
Me too.
Next EKG, Brett. Let's go. Now, this one is near and dear to my heart because my family has been impacted by cancer. And I think there are countless others who have been impacted by cancer. But this one is a celebratory story. Doctors, this is June 4th now, doctors are reporting and they're hailing the world's first as women's advanced breast cancer is eradicated. Like that story, you know,
Oh, it's heartstrings for me as well. My mom is a dual cancer survivor along other women in my family. So I read this one and I said, okay.
It's on now. It's on, right? So who are these doctors? Okay. How do we, GoFundMe? What do y'all need, right?
Yeah.
Because a woman with advanced breast cancer. Now, you know, it has spread around her body. She has been completely cleared of this disease through this groundbreaking therapy. And the therapy literally uses the power of her immune system to fight the tumors. Look at God, right? It's already here. So it's all inside.
It's from the earth.
It's all here, right? And so this is the first time that a patient with late stage breast cancer has been successfully treated. And, you know, there's several rounds of, you know, routine, chemotherapy that has occurred. And that failed to stop the tumor in the right breast from growing and spreading to her liver. And they gave her 3 years.
And now God's given her life.
Listen, she's still here. She's like the treatment she had given up fighting. This is one of her reported statements. And literally, she said that her name is Judy Perkins. She's an engineer from Florida. She was 49 when she went through this. She said, and I want you to hear this, and you understand this by having an immediate family member go through this. She said after the treatment dissolved most of her tumor, she was able to go for a 40-mile hike.
Wow.
Yo, that's crazy. Wow. That is so amazing. I'm really
wonderful
excited about that. Laszlo Radvanyi, who's the scientific director of the Ontario Institute for Cancer Research, he's saying, look, this is an unprecedented response into, you know, such a thing as advanced breast cancer. Now, the doctors who care for the woman at the U.S. National Cancer Institute in Maryland said that, you know, this is remarkable for us. And so now, and experts have chimed in, but they're saying that we're at a cusp of a major revolution and finally realizing the elusive goal of being able to deal with the plethora of mutations in cancer through immunotherapy. I'm really excited about that.
I am too. I think we're going into, and it's only half the year, so we are going into 2019 with some great expectations. Especially since, you know, doctors are finding cancer early on and, you know, in young women.
Yeah.
So now that we have a little bit more options that's available, I'm looking for what help they need. Right. Mm-hmm. So probably not in terms of that, but you know, how we can advocate to make sure everybody has access to.
Well, it's going to go through phases, right?
Yeah,
and so the next phase is now clinical trials. And so we know clinical trials, they now have dealt with one individual case. They're going to now try and replicate this and ensure that across bodies, across, you know, different, biometrical setups that this treatment could apply and actually, be equally as effective as it was for Judy. But the thing is, it happened with Judy.
It did.
So, you know, hope is there, and I'm truly excited. It will be an amazing thing in the next 5 to 10 years if our breast cancer walks are now, you know, just they're just celebrations of treatment.
Actually,
not
so I think,
surviving.
Yeah, well, there, yeah, like that. So there's another. Well, Breast Cancer Month is September.
I think
it's
not sure.
September, maybe one of those months.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's October. That's something to walk for, you know.
So I think some of the, you know, I'm hoping that by this time clinical trials have at least begun or will, be in some level of a stage of implementation and that we can have that conversation on Breast Cancer Month. I think we need to do a few shows around that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to talk to the National Cancer Institute, and get some people on the show. It is October,
it's
as
October.
You just pulled it up. And so, let's plan for that and actually begin to talk about how we can support these kind of efforts or at least get the information out and get people into some of these clinical trials.
It would be
great to ensure, that we have, you know, individuals even from our area who may be able to qualify and go through the trials based on how they set up the parameters. But I'm excited about that. Make sure you share this article, definitely for, the women who you love in your life and care for. I think it's important, to let them know that help is on the way.
It is.
And, even for men, understanding, look, if they can handle this with breast cancer, there are so many other cancers that could, also be addressed through this particular, process. That is our EKGs, for the week. I love the fact that we're ending on such a positive one, right?
Note.
I mean, a really, really positive one. You know, our guests are in the studio. I'm really excited. They're in the green room, actually, and so I'm looking forward to having them on the show, Power of the Pen, two amazing authors and mentors who are doing some amazing work and have some amazing stories that are just, you know, changing the landscape. I'm going to go really quickly into our Black History Fact of the Week. Here at Heart of the City, we do Black History every week. Why? Because we make Black History every day. If you don't believe me, take a breath. Breathe out. There you go. Teresa just made history and so did you, the focus of our Black History Fact of this week, Jerry Lawson. You may not know his name, but if you pull up a PS4, if you play Tom Clancy's Wildlands every night like I do, as Ed laughs at me, right? If you have the virtual headset for PS and PS4, and if you have the Xbox One and 360, if you went through Atari 2600, Commodore 64, ColecoVision, and Sega Genesis, you need to thank Jerry Lawson. Why? Because he is the one who brought interchangeable video games into people's homes. He started with the Fairchild Channel F. Never even heard of it. That was the video game console that was the precursor to modern video game systems. Now, Jerry considered George Washington Carver as one of his inspirations. He was inspired by his work, and so he dabbled in electronics, repairing televisions before going to Queens College and then City University in New York. He then went in the 70s to Silicon Valley. I know everybody thinks Mark Zuckerberg is the only one there. No. Jerry Lawson, a brother, was there. He was a member of the Homebrew Computer Club, of which he was the only black member of the time. In fact, in that club, he crossed paths with Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. In fact, in an interview, he was reported as saying, Steve is, he's business-minded, he's a spark plug, but I was unimpressed with him when I interviewed him for a job. Grown man business, Jerry Lawson. So Jerry went on to create the Fairchild Channel F, a home entertainment machine that was produced in 1976 by Fairchild Semiconductor, where he worked as the director of engineering. Through his system, it allowed people to play a variety of games in their homes and paved the way for the Atari 2600 and Nintendo, Xbox, PlayStation, the list goes on. He said, I'm one of those guys that if you tell me I can't do something, I'm going to turn around and do it. He said, many of his colleagues were surprised to find out that he was African American. He said, with them, it became an issue, but for me, it didn't really matter. All black people don't look one way, all black people don't sound one way, and all black people don't do the same things. And he would say, I know you guys are mad. I'm sorry I'm not. Mm-hmm. Jerry Lawson, the man.
He's a household name.
Yes, he is. Jerry Lawson, thank you so much.
Thank you,
he actually,
Jerry.
You know, we're celebrating his total life because he transitioned in California April 9th, 2011 due to complications with diabetes. It's one of the reasons why you need to get checked. He was survived by his wife, Catherine, and her two children. Our Black History Fact of the Week, we celebrate Jerry Lawson, the pioneer of the home video game system. We'll make sure that we post that on the Facebook page. Please share that, especially with the kids who are on their smartphones right now playing games. And, you know, as you're sitting there playing, you know, 2K and whatever other games you want to play, Madden, with your children, let them know that it was one of us that made an impact.
We need like a Heart City Jerry Lawson Award.
Yeah, we do.
I love it.
We do. For those who are
gamers,
changing the landscape in technology. We are crossing that second hour, and I'm going to give a quick station ID. You're listening to WWDB 860 AM, the show Heart of the City. The topic today, the power of the pen. We're dealing with healing, learning, and loving through our literary works. I'm going to go into a song of the week. When I come back, we'll have our guest in the studio, and we'll break down with John Cameron and Bridget Martin Holmes their stories, the stories that they penned through their books, their mentorship opportunities, their focus on making an impact. And we'll talk about why reading is so important, not just for us as adults, but for our children and our future generations. The song of the week, I'm taking you back a little bit. I know I've been dating myself over the last couple of weeks. I'm sorry. I just love classic music. This is Jodeci, Love You for Life.
Promises you made me, all the things you told me to. close the door. Let me show you what I could be. Could you just please tell me?
Is a classic record. We can go through that whole album. John is nodding his head like, yes, sir, we can. That is Love You for Life, I promise you. Go download that Jodeci album. Look, Love You for Life is a classic record for those of us who are over the age of... And so here's the thing. Don't do it on a torrent. Download that thing. It's $1.29. Support the brothers. Keep their catalog floating, right? Devontae and KC need it, all right? And JoJo might need it too a little bit. John out of his head.
They in bad shape, some of them.
They in bad shape. They in bad shape. We don't, you know, they need that. I'm just going to leave it there. In the studio, Jonathan Cameron, CEO of the Cameron Group. And Bridget Martin Holmes, the founder of Monologues of a Poetic Mistress. I know. Y'all are like, what? I need like, go to that because I want to need to know what that's about. I promise you it's going to blow your mind. But first, a heart of the city. Welcome to the both of you.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure
to have you both. Thank you. Been checking you guys out. You both are doing some great work in some amazing spaces, right? And so we always talk about literary works. Mm-hmm. And in the black community, we always go to, you know, Zane or so. We always go to these particular genres. Right. We never talk about those who are writing some real heartfelt stories and stories that we always go to Toni Morrison's when we want to go, you know, in that direction. And we need Van Zant to write something on self-help. Mm-hmm. But we overlook some of the great authors of our time that I think are local, which is why I think it was absolutely important to have you guys on the show. Thanks to Lance, our talent booker, who does some amazing research on guests. So I'm going to break this down. So, all right, we're going to start with you, Bridget, because okay. Everybody's like, no, I need to talk about this whole, you know, poetic mistress monologue thing, right? So let's just get that out the way. You titled this thing Monologues of a Poetic Mistress. The mic is yours. Break it down and tell the listening audience your reasoning and the purpose behind such a attention-grabbing name.
Well, the Monologues of a Poetic Mistress started out as a book.
Wow.
And then it ended up changing. I got a phone call from a young lady who lived through domestic violence.
Wow.
And it turned over from a book into a stage presentation where we talk about domestic violence, child abuse, and mm-hmm. sex trafficking. So the monologues is five women mm-hmm. who tell their truth about domestic violence and child abuse.
Wow.
One of the young ladies, Francine, she was set on fire. 85% of her body was set on fire, and she lived through that. But her abuser ended up dying in the fire. Then we have a young lady named Ira Warren. She's on the radio as well now.
Yeah.
And Ira talks about the abuse that she lived through with her siblings, with her father,
mm-hmm.
Who has sexually abused her, and she ended up having a son.
Wait.
Yeah.
Had a son with the father?
With the father, yeah.
Wow.
So she gets to tell her story, her truth. Then we have another young lady who was 60 years old. I fly out of Cincinnati, named Carolyn Stevenson, and she talks about the abuse she had at her uncle's hands in The Neighbor.
Mm.
So all these different women, Ashley Howard, she tells her story as a young girl who of two sons. One is disabled, who lived through abuse and kidnapping and things like that. And Renee Jones runs an organization called Hope out of Florida, and she tells mm-hmm. her story of being sex trafficked, taken from one state to another state, locked in a room and being sexually abused over and over again.
So, you know, I would love to say that we planned this show this way. So we planned it from the book perspective and the literary perspective. Ironically, Representative Cephas, Morgan Cephas, she's state, representative out of Philadelphia. She was just on doing her segment. And one of the big things that she talked about today that she's chairing the caucus, and dealing with the topic of sex trafficking
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, it's this overlooked thing, right? Mm-hmm. In Philly, we see girls disappearing and we just want to put them in a runaway category and never really dig deeper into, to, you know, what's happening. I want to do one other thing because we're going to make this a round robin. I'm going to bring in, on the line, I have Helen Irwin. She is an amazing author. I've been following her on social media, Twitter and, Facebook. She, this book that had caught my eye is Jane's Journey. And I'm going to talk more about, that book and some of the great things that she's doing, but I want to get her on the line and get her in the conversation. A Heart of the City. Welcome to you, Helen. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you.
It's an honor to have you. And so I'm going to get to you too and your story. Jonathan, the Cameron Group. I mean, you have 25 years.
Yeah.
Of professional experience in education, entrepreneurship, you could have gone a whole different way. You know, you could have just balled out. you got the tenure, you have the resources, the education. But you said, no, I'm going to switch this up and I'm going to start this group to help others. And you became a mentor in the midst of it.
Listen, Malik, you know, I've been doing this a long time, said 25 years. And, you know, I have a couple degrees, but mm-hmm. I tell people I'm a straight foot soldier.
Mm.
Always been a foot soldier. That's all I know how to do. I worked in like real serious lockdown facilities when I first got out. Because I'm 51 years old, so
right.
I worked in facilities that don't really exist no more.
Okay.
Where hardened juveniles shared rooms with kids who might have just stole a car. So
wow.
You got a kid who maybe, you know, attempted murder or murder. His roommate just stole a car. So mm-hmm. his perspective was still in the car. You know, I'll be out soon. This other kid's perspective is I'm gonna do juvenile life, which is 18. They don't have that in Pennsylvania anymore.
Right.
And then I go to jail. So his mindset is totally different.
Yeah, yeah.
So I worked at a place called Ferris School for Boys, similar to Cornwall Heights in PA. And I did that for like 15 years. And I got to see really bond and really have strong relationship with these kids. And then we'd be out playing basketball on his 18th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And the correction officer come get them. And
wow.
now they got to go serve a whole nother set
yeah,
of
yeah,
time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but what really hit me was in 2011, I had one of my kids, his name was Shannon Johnson, rest in peace. He went to jail for murder. He was on death row.
Mm-hmm.
And, he decided he did not want to stay on death row. So he ended his life. So he petitioned to the state of Delaware to be executed. So he's 30 years old, but he said, I'm not doing this no more.
Yeah.
So then he sent letters out to a lot of my colleagues and he was executed. And I said, we got to do something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? There's no way we can sit and let this keep going on and on and on and these guys losing their lives and, you know, and we're not doing anything about it. We're crying mm-hmm. at funerals, but we're not stepping up and showing some direction.
Listen, and I'm, I respect the whole teddy bear ministry mm-hmm. and the street pole. I get it.
Right.
But it's so symbolic at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It has to be something that goes beyond that, right? Mm-hmm. And we can't get left there and just celebrating that. And so it's really great that you went into that. You started a boys leadership conference.
Yes.
Which is unique, because most people would go in the system by 15 years in, you're like, I'm burnt out. I'm good. I'm done. I'm going to take my pension and
it was times I was like, I ain't coming back.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, the doubles, cause mm-hmm. you get froze, as they call it. So if you don't go to work, I got to stay.
Right.
And just, you make good money, but just mentally it's draining, because right. building relationships, and then you look on the newspaper, John Cameron was just murdered.
Yeah.
You know, you said, I remember when he was when he was 17.
Yeah.
So I tell people, I have a whole unit I can still visualize, and everybody's dead. There's like 27 of them.
Are you serious?
Everybody's dead. So, like you said, it can be mentally.
Right.
So when I went back to school, I got my master's in counseling to kind of help me deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got to dump that stuff off somewhere
right.
where it'll drive you crazy.
Right.
So I said, you know, these young guys, they going through so much, and we got to figure how we can help them, the trauma from working in schools.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, I'm a climate manager at Frankfort High School. So basically, I'm the guy who deal with all the police issues. And
yeah.
So I'm still dealing with, but I'm dealing with a more corrective way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sending you to jail. I might suspend you,
yeah.
but I'm bringing you back and correct you. So
I'm trying to keep you on the other side of the wall.
Yeah, I'm trying to. So I said, let me start doing these conferences. So the first one we had was last Saturday. We had about 30 boys attend. I created a 9-point character development program, and we had a workshop on finances, how to stunt but still have your money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're gonna buy.
There you go.
Don't be broke about
it.
Mm-hmm. And then we had another parenting piece, just how moms should kind of deal with their sons. Because, you know, I brought a card here, resolve a conflict with your son, so I'm leaving for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I tell you, it's different. Dealing with a boy is a little different than girls. For number one, you're screaming at a boy, there's a piece in their brain that's sensitive.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just talk about that kind of stuff. And I'm going to do one in Chester with my friend Darren Laws. We're going to do one dealing with how to help your son deal with trauma. So we're going to keep going and going. You know, I'm trying to, right now I'm selling T-shirts to keep it going. But I'm like, you know, I ain't worrying about no money. We're going to get this thing going no matter what.
Yeah.
It's funny he said that, because I was just talking to him out in the lobby and telling him I just did a documentary on the fatherless child.
Mm-hmm.
And
it
documented all young boys who have grown up without their father. So I was telling him we can get together and do that.
Yeah. There you go.
That. Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Also, I'm going to leave you guys with some T-shirts. This is our drive right now. Never too young to lead. I only had two, but you guys, these are for you guys.
Yeah.
And this is kind of how I finance, you know, places and bringing therapists.
We will support.
So these are for you guys.
So you heard John say you're never too young to lead. I mean, I don't mean to get spiritual on you, but the book did say, "And a child shall lead them." I'm just going to leave that right there for you to go to. Helen Irwin, an amazing author. She has, I just love her insight. I love everything that I've been able to see in her body of work. Now, Helen, you left Helsingborg, Sweden in the early 90s and hit the streets of New York City. Which
I did.
I mean, New York, and I remember because I was – I came into New York maybe about like 98, 99, but New York was, it's one of those hustle and bustle. You got to hit the ground.
Running.
Yes.
But you went there and found inspiration in the social justice movement and the multiculturalism that existed inside of, you know, all the numerous neighborhoods and small pockets of culture that we have. You know, one would, we get caught up in stereotypes and perspectives all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If one were to just look at you and look at your Twitter account, they would assume that you are not going to be a writer about social justice. You might write a novel about love or whatever their prejudice may block them from seeing, or whatever their expectations of you may be. But you have said, no, I'm going to focus on history, and I'm going to tell history, and we're going to talk about some conversations, and even in James' journey, you write that from the almost like this narrative about a son of a slave owner who turned an abolitionist, right, and then became a conductor on The Underground Railroad. Those are books, to be frank, that in the African American culture we do not have many that come from that perspective.
Exactly.
And it's so exciting to see that book, and you'll love this, guys. The bookmark that she has like Frederick Douglass on it. I mean, she gives you this amazing package. Helen, talk to the listening audience about, you know, what drove you from that passion point to write in this perspective and give this historical, context and perspective on slavery and just America's past as it relates to social justice.
Oh, that's a great question. Well, let me see how I can start. I've always been fascinated by the people who dare to leave their mold where they grew up.
Wow.
And look at what other people say. 'Cause it's very easy to, you live your life, you, all the people you have around you, they tell you something and you just listen to that, you live your life, and that's what, how you were raised, that's your community, everything reinforces how you, what you should think and what you should do and what kind of political, the politics you should follow. But then there are the few throughout history and today that say, you know, this isn't really what, this is not how it is. I want to look further than my family have done, and I want to see for myself what this really is. And often I think it takes somebody leaving their environment before they see it. And James, my character, he was he grew up with on a plantation with enslaved labor, and he didn't question it. His whole community lived like that. He had several friends and neighbors, they all enslaved people, and that's just how he thought how he was. And he'd heard about abolitionists in the North then, and he thought that, no, they don't really know how it is here. And he was raised with the plantation myth, which is that the enslaved people, they, you know, it was good for them to be enslaved and they were happy there. And that's how he was raised, and they used the Bible to justify this. When in the beginning of the story, there are several things that happen that just kind of poke at him a little bit, and he's still defending it, but there's a little couple of things that just poke at his consciousness. Then he leaves the plantation in Virginia and travels to New York to study medicine, which was pretty unusual for somebody who grew up wealthy due to slave labor, but he already was a spirit who wanted to leave and try something else, and he realized that everybody didn't agree, and that there were other people out there who had different viewpoints on life. And I think in a way my own journey from Sweden, growing up in a very small town, when I lived there we didn't have a lot of immigration and everyone was the same, and I didn't like that. I wanted to see something else. I wanted to meet more people, and the influence that I got from meeting an international community in New York City was life-changing. And I think some of James' character comes from that shift of moving from one place to another and get a different perspective and learning the truth. And it took James quite a while before he understood what slavery really was and how horrible it was and that it was wrong. And then he changed everything about his life to help his father's enslaved people flee. And it wasn't easy. When he went back to Virginia with his wife, who was an abolitionist, the neighbors did not approve of his newfound ideology at all. And it was very hard for him. But I think that's also telling how it is when, if you have something new that you have learned and you introduce that to your family or your friends or your community, they don't always approve, and they think that you're wrong. And then that's the crucial point, I think, if you still dare to say, you know what, this is still wrong, I need to do what's right.
So I think you just hit a very, very critical point, Helen, because You know, I say this all the time, and I'll never forget, you know, one of my most recent experiences over the last few years of meeting an individual who was roughly about 20 or so during the times of the water hoses and you know, some of the major issues that we had in the 60s. And mm-hmm. I'll never forget talking to her about an individual that I was asking her to support. And she said, well, you know, I'm going to support her because she's friends with my granddaughter, but you should support her too, because she's going to be good for your kind. And it was that, it was like that, first of all, I was floored. I didn't know what to say. I was speechless, but, for me specifically, I think the generation that still exists from that time, mm-hmm. their mindsets are locked.
Yeah.
In many ways, some of the children are locked with slight doors every now and then, depending on what occurs. And now it's the future generations that I believe that are going to look at works like yours and John's and Bridget's and actually be able to say, you know what? My canvas is a little clear, a little more clear. I'm a little more open to exploring and being okay with being different than my surrounding. Mm-hmm. Do you find that the mindset in some of the youth that you encounter in your walk in New York?
Yeah. I think young people, and I just have to say I love how you describe it as doors. I think young people are much more able to see with a more open mind, with open doors, and really clearly look at the whole picture.
Yeah.
But like you said, their parents may still be holding them back a little bit.
Yeah.
And we are still dealing with a lot of racism in this country that took me as a Swedish person quite a while to understand when I first moved here. Because in Sweden, I don't want to say that we don't have racism. We absolutely do. But it's different than here. And it took me quite a while to really understand how much is left.
Yeah.
And, but to get back to the younger generation, I think in a generation or two, I think we will have come much further. I really, really hope. But right now it looks bleak, and but one of the reasons I also made my thought with James is that he was the next generation in his family. And usually each generation hopefully takes one step closer.
Gets a little better.
It evolves a little bit with each generation. One should hope.
It should. And so one of the things that you said, which I totally agree with, because I say it's not going to be my generation. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be my child's generation. It's actually going to be their children that will actually have a clean palate, right? And so, Bridget, you've experienced this. I mean, you're dealing with early childhood education. I mean, you've seen that for years. You see the predictors developing children. You've also steered them around some of the factors that would lead them down certain paths. It is our young folk. How do we get them interested? Because, you know, thanks to George Lawson, Ed, everybody's in PlayStation 4 and they're in Xbox and they're in, you know, whatever, Nintendo. How do we get them leaning towards some of the work that you guys are putting together through your books and through your publications? What's the blueprint? Because nobody wants to read anymore. Everybody has a smartphone. They want to do the Twitter timeline, the Facebook timeline. But Bridget, you're seeing it early out. What are some of the ways that we can move this forward?
Conversation.
Yep.
Just like we're having right here.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I do with my documentary with all the young men that are in that take part in that. It's conversation.
Wow.
You can't heal what you can't hear.
Mm-hmm.
Say that one more again.
You can't heal what you can't hear.
You can't heal what you can't hear.
That's right.
Wow.
So in order to heal it, we have to have conversations. We have to have sit-down conversations. The barbershops, mm-hmm. when we're in the barbershops, old folks sitting in those chairs have to start having conversations so that our young men are hearing this conversation mm-hmm. in our beauty salons.
The barbershop was life. It's life changing.
Yes. Yes.
It's life changing. Yes. I mean, you know, and for men, and I had this conversation last week, because someone had like not a disagreement with me, but they believed that men had just as many resources to heal as women, and I'm like, no. Absolutely not. You know, there's something in women's DNA. You guys come together, especially if a man did it. y'all are on point, right? But as men, we have so many stereotypes we have to get over.
You better not cry.
We're challenging each other, right? Yeah. You know, who has to be the alpha male in this group? Yeah. And so, John, you're mentoring these young men, right? And so they're dealing with that same kind of mentality that's stopping them from coming together and saying, hey, you know what? You got to go to this five pillars of leadership. Mm-hmm. You got to deal with this program that John is doing. Or you have to read the latest book by, you know, Bridget, and get it to your sister, or have a conversation, or even have a conversation about James Journey and Frederick Douglass and abolitionists who were on the other side at one point, right? Right. Those are conversations we don't have in the barbershop.
Right.
How do we get there, especially with our young men?
Okay. Like, it's funny because I had a parent come all the way from Bullingbrook, New Jersey, mm-hmm. and she brought five of her sons to the conference. And she said, I told them, no AAU basketball today, no soccer, no nothing.
Yeah.
We're going to start talking about your character.
Wow.
And so, like you said, through conversation, we as parents, mm-hmm. As adults, we got to say, Hope, put the phone down for a minute.
Yeah.
We got to go back to, let's eat together. So, because a lot of stuff I learned at the table with my mom and dad.
That dining room table was phenomenal, wasn't it? Kitchen table, whatever
it
was.
Yeah. So, we got to kind of go, I mean, I know people are busy, but we got to start going back to that, whereas we got just family time.
Yep.
Where we just talk about what's going on and just ask your son, how was your day?
But when you think about it, I mean, honestly think about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much you're really doing at dinner time for real. I mean, if you really want to be deliberate mm-hmm. about it, and I'm checking myself too, right? So there are times when I get home and I'm like, I just, you know, I had a rough day.
Right.
I want to put my feet up. I'm going to watch CNN for a couple minutes. Then I'm going to play this, you know, Tom Clancy Wildlands for about 30 minutes because I have to detox from everything else. Mm-hmm. But there is an opportunity.
There is an
for me to switch that up and detox by having a conversation with my daughter, you know, and say, hey, how was your day?
But not only that, you're learning, you know how to detox. Nobody's teaching our children how to detox. Our children are going from one thing to the next thing, fast paced. The world is running so fast, and our children are being left behind. Like I tell people, just take a minute, just hear them. I watch them on the subway, the vulgar language and everything, and I'm always checking somebody's child on the subway.
It's crazy.
And I don't have a problem. I mean, we have gotten so far from being afraid of saying anything to someone else's children.
Exactly.
They're hurting. They're crying out. Like you said, the barbershop.
Mm-hmm.
My next documentary is in the barbershop. Prison home.
There you go.
Brothers going to talk about not having their fathers in their lives, but it's the reason why I went to prison. It's the reason why I didn't graduate from school. Mm-hmm. The whole dynamics of the family has changed. Mothers have gotten younger.
Yeah.
Fathers have gotten younger. Yeah. Grandmothers are younger now. So
it's really crazy. I mean, when you talk about, you know, a 40-year-old grandmother, that's like, I don't understand that. I didn't understand that, right? I thought grandmoms had, you know, doilies and, you know, wore long and that's my own, you know, challenges just because of the way that I was raised. But life has changed, and it has evolved in a very major way. But, John, you brought up something that, Helen, I want you to really talk about, because the characters in your book kind of speak to this character, right? And being able to break down character and what that looks like. What you need around you and what you don't need around, and then also the character of change.
Yeah.
Because you can start one way and change and become another, right? And so there's a redemptive spirit that also can be embodied and embraced.
Right.
So Helen, you have characters in your book like Moncure Conway and Henry Beecher, you know, and you put them on the on your bookmark. But these are individuals who had some challenging journeys themselves. I mean, you know, Moncure, was a guy who was an abolitionist, right? And they loved him to death, but he's also, you know, known for some challenging things in his life. You weave them into your storyline. What was the reasoning for those individuals? Cause I mean, it wasn't just them. You also brought in, James McCune, I believe, right?
Yeah, Dr. McCune Smith, the first African American
medical doctor.
Yeah.
So talk about why you weave those individuals into this book.
Okay, let me first start with Moncure Conway. I came upon by chance, actually. My husband and I were driving around to look at Underground Railroad sites. And we had been driving, or I should be honest here, I hate driving. So my husband had been driving
the
whole time. Yes.
Get me there.
And to drive me around so I could do research for my book. And we were exhausted. And we had booked a motel. And we found another motel. We just saw the sign along the highway, and it was much cheaper. And we said, you know what? We're exhausted. Let's just go and see if they have availability. Or actually, we called them and they had availability, and we canceled our original stop where we were going to stay for the night, and we went to Fredericksburg. Yeah. And of course, I started Googling, and I find that Moncure Conway lived right around the corner, and he was somebody very similar to James. Somebody who grew up with enslaved labor and who was pro-slavery first and then changed his mind and helped his father's slaves leave. And I hadn't heard of him. Hmm. And he was amazing. And he became a minister. Mm-hmm. and he was fired for his abolitionist views. And then found another church, a Unitarian church, where he worked, where he was accepted. And it's a similar story to James, in that he was pro-slavery first and then realized how wrong it was and changed his mind and did something about it. But Moncure Conway Dr. McCune Smith was more, I wanted James to, when he came to New York, I wanted him to really see and to get his stereotypes challenged. And so he meets Catherine's family, and this is before they met and got married. And he is invited to dinner, and suddenly the doorbell rings, and Dr. McCune Smith and his wife, they're a little late, so they're already sitting down to dinner, and everyone says, oh, hello, Dr. McCune, come on in. And he sees an African-American man, and he's a doctor, and he's floored. And that's when it really, really, really starts to pick at his brain. And this is not what I was taught. And it snowballs after this. And there's one thing after the other. And something you mentioned earlier about young people that I think is very, very important, not just for young people, but for everyone, is that we don't just blindly follow stereotypes. That when we hear a stereotype, that we look at it and listen and see, but wait, I don't have to just repeat this. I can see why and how, why is there a stereotype? And I would say 99.9%, it's a false stereotype. And we don't need to just repeat these stereotypes, because that's what keeps pushing racism and everything forward, by just blindly repeating these things that are false. And I think we're better than that. I think we can challenge ourselves to think for ourselves and not just take these at what you call it, face value, and really, and that's how you bring about change. And I think that's how the next generation will hopefully stop listening to our old stereotypes and will start to have their own story, and with more diversity and develop, more inclusion.
Develop some truths, right? And so Bridget, you know, even just taking what Helen just talked about in developing truths and being able to break away from what you're told or just what you see, right? Because sometimes it's the environment. This is all I see. Right. So it must be true, right? Sure. You know, specifically with the amount of what I see in the course of a day. Something very personal happened for you in 2008. And you lost your eyesight for a brief moment. Mm-hmm. I'm just going on a limb here. Mm-hmm. But that did something. Mm-hmm. And I would probably say that you saw more during that moment than you probably have done with full eyesight. What was that?
I saw the world differently. I valued the things that I couldn't see anymore. So, I tell people that all the time. And when I got my eyesight back, and my first prayer to God was, show me the world through a child's eye. Because so often we as adults only see things our way. Mm-hmm. So I pray, God, when you give me my eyesight, because of the things I took for granted, that I was going to see the trees tomorrow, I was going to see the water tomorrow, I was going to see my children, my family again tomorrow. Mm. I want you to show me what children see. They don't see color. They don't see the bad. Show me what they see so I can see it through their eyes so that way I can live my life that way. And that's the whole cause of the ABC, They Look Like Me book, the monologue poetic mistress book and platform, the documentary I've done. Mm. I want to see things through the children's eyes because I want change to come about. And until we as adults, as a community, as a tribe, a village, we start seeing it through the children's eyes, there's no change going to happen. Because children see what they mimic what they see.
They do.
They mimic what they see. So losing my sight, I mean, it just made me see the world differently.
You know what's interesting? Go ahead, Helen. You wanted to say something there?
No, that's powerful. I have goose pimples.
Yeah,
I mean. Thank you for sharing that.
It really is. And so when you think about that, John, it's most young men do not visually see an example of what we need them to see in order to kind of have, you know, resources or at least a mindset, right, of success, right? Yeah. Because the father figure may not be there. The mentors may not be present, right? Yeah. And so they are in many ways blind.
Yep. I tell them every day.
To the possibilities.
Exactly.
Right? And so and books are so important to the brain seeing. Mm-hmm. Because no matter what Helen writes about in James's journey, when she's writing about that, I have to visualize it, right? And as she writes, it takes me there. As you write about those principles of leadership and you give storylines, I visually see it. Mm-hmm. You know this well in early childhood education, Bridget. Our children are some of the most imaginative we have, right? And so they're the ones that can take a cardboard box and it's the Millennium Falcon and they're, right? And they see it all.
They want
right?
the cardboard box.
They see it all. And so how do we keep developing the eyesight that goes beyond the physical?
Mm-hmm. I believe we got to continue to model the positive behavior. Like you said, you don't see a lot of, you know, let's say men that look like, but the ones who there, we got to embrace them. Mm-hmm. And we got to show them this is what a man looks like. This is what a man does. And you have to, so they can walk and they can see it. You can't just talk about, well, when I was your age, I this and that. They don't work like that. You have to show these guys. It's that group. They have to see it.
Right.
You know, they have to see if you save your money, but you don't have an expensive car without a mortgage, you got a liability. And you, the more you talk to them and embrace them, some are really tough. I tell them, you got to almost catch them before they turn that corner.
Right.
You know, but you got to just keep, it's a fight. It's an uphill fight. But I think you got to keep educating them. You got to get support from the whole family, from the whole community. We got to get back to confronting kids, like you said, like we got confronted, you know, by the time my mom got home, I was going to get it again.
You're going to get a workout.
Yeah.
You're going to get a workout.
Yep. So I think we had to go back to those days and bring it all back in.
But I think also too, you know, the response from a young kid as they see you is going to be totally different when they see Bridget.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, eyesight is insight.
Mm-hmm.
So in order, what you see is what you mimic. So if I see it with my eyes and you giving me an insight of what it looks like, then I can mimic that behavior. So eyesight is insight. You got to see it, and then you got to see it in me, and then it'll
come out of you. Yep. So I want to deal with something really quickly, right? Because we've talked about mindset, and some of that mindset has been created specifically, it's been engineered for us, right? Some of it just comes by impact, social, economic impact. This is where I am. This is my neighborhood. This is what it looks like.
This is what we do.
This is what we do, right? But the big conversation across, you know, America, whether you're on the left or the right politically and all the, you know, the acknowledgement of some of the challenges of communities has gone just totally to the left, right? And so, and if we say this group has experienced trauma, and quite frankly, you know, people of color. Now, when they say people of color have experienced trauma, we're like, yeah, but you're here now. Get up and keep moving, right? You know, we hear that, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. I just got a pair of bootstraps, right? So I got to figure out, you know, first of all, I finance those. I got to pay for them.
How many bootstraps do I got to pull up?
How many? You know, and so we go through that process as a culture. On the other side of that, you know, there are those who, and I'm going to be challenged by a few, you know, African Americans. I get it. But everybody's not a colonizer. Nor is everybody supportive of you even in your own culture, right? So we gotta kill all of that, right? Because there are those, you know, there are those who support the cause. That's where I think we have to lay this now. And we see that in, books and authors who are deliberate, like, Helen, and we celebrate the work that you're doing, because you even talk about, a women's struggle during, the time where they're fighting for suffrage in Sweden. That's your next publication. And so you talk about the sorcery trials in the 17th century in Sweden. And like, you're talking about it from all these various viewpoints. The truth is, when those boats landed in Africa, they came looking for trade and a quicker route, you know, through. And then they came a couple more times, and then they ended up taking 10 slaves back.
Right.
40 more years, they got permission from an African king to put a trading post up, which meant somebody in the crew decided that this is what we're going to do. We're going to sell ourselves. It became a hustle, right? But then on the flip side, there are also those who are not African American who have made a conscious effort to tell the story and to give it voice in ways that we cannot, right? And so, Helen, the country's in turmoil because we don't want to believe that, you know, civil rights were really that big of an issue. We don't, you know, some will say that, you know, affirmative action, you know, was unfair. And so we have all of that going on. And in the midst of that, you're writing about suffrage. You're writing about social justice. What do you see over the next couple years of, and I don't want to talk about a particular administration because I think it's about people in general and hearts, right? But what do you see over the next 5 years happening as a culture, as we begin to see more discussion, as we begin to see more sides become vocal, sometimes in their extremism, right? You're kind of like in the middle ground. You're like, here's the facts of it, and I'm going to talk about it in a very unique way. But but what's the future look like for us in the next 5 years as a nation?
Well, what I'm hoping, and I'm speaking for myself here, but what I'm hoping is that more white Americans become allies and really look at the history and don't think that we're separate from it. And I'm hoping that people are noticing that we are one country with citizens from all over the planet, and we should work together. And I can see, you see a lot of the other side too, and I'm not going to mention any administration either, but you do see people who are passionate now, who are really like, no, I'm not standing for this. I want equal rights and I want everyone to live together. And I see you and I understand. I haven't been in your shoes and personally as well. I can't speak for that. I have not walked down the street and been judged due to my skin color. So I can't speak for that, but I can observe it and I can see it. And I can say, you know what, this isn't right. And as an ally and as an American now, I became a citizen in 2016, just before the election. And I think the future may see more people as allies and working together to try to bring about change. I'm hoping for that.
I do believe that, and I do think that is going to happen. You know, Bridget, you have a motto: never get bigger than the purpose. Man, that's like a whole T-shirt, book, workshop.
You know? Bridget wrote that.
Right, right.
So, that.
Yeah, I'm like,
Bridget wrote that.
Goodness.
Heard it
first. Put a little trademark on it. That's Bridget Martin Holmes, okay? Right. All rights reserved. I got you. I covered you. So never get bigger than the purpose. What is our purpose? Why are we here at this moment? We have three amazing authors right here telling the human experience in amazing ways. What is our purpose? We're here together. So the Creator put us here at this moment. What are we here to do?
I believe this was purposed for me to be here, because not only you're giving all your listeners the opportunity to hear what I'm actually doing in the community, but it binded me with another step, someone else.
Right.
Okay,
right.
A gentleman here,
right,
who's actually out doing the work and holding the conferences,
yeah,
where I need to be showing my material. So that's got a purpose.
Yep.
And
you got
I don't get
on.
Bigger than that, because it's about his platform,
yeah,
but I'm going to add something to his platform without taking something away. And that's what I tell our people. We have to learn to collaborate as African Americans. We got to stop trying to be crabs in a barrel and start how to collaborate with each other and know that I'm coming into your organization to help enhance it. I'm not trying to take anything from it.
Absolutely.
I'm not trying to get the light to shine on me.
Yep.
I'm just trying to say, hey, this pie is big enough for the both of us to eat. God gives me my purpose, I stay in my lane. Yeah. God gives you your purpose, you stay in your lane. So let me do what I do good and you do what you do good and watch it. Watch it grow out. Because I hear you saying, is there going to be change in America? Yes, there's going to be change in America, because it's not just happening to us anymore.
Yeah.
It's happening to everybody else.
Everybody.
And because it's happening to everybody else, everybody is going to get on the picket line together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But as long as it's happening to us, nobody cares. But now that it's happening to everybody, so our schools aren't the ones getting shot up and blown up.
Right.
But because of that, now we're going to get
now
change
we're
in
dealing
who gets
with
the bullets and the
guns. Yeah, yeah.
So that's what.
That's big, understanding that, you know, there might be other factors that create the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's
correct.
Not just you bringing it to bear, but being prepared for the conversation as it comes, right?
Yes.
And so, I tell you guys all the time, and we used to say this when we were a 1-hour show, you know, we only have 60 minutes to get through over 60 years of experience, right?
Correct.
So, it's a 2-hour show, 120 minutes, but I still have over 120 years of experience through our guests, right? I'm not able to do it all, right? So, here's the thing. We're going to take a minute on each. I want you guys to tell the listening audience where they can purchase the book, where they can connect with you, especially the mentorship programs, the conference. Helen, I want you to do the same. Bridget, you close us out. All right? Take it away,
John. Okay. All right. Like I said, I'm John Cameron, CEO of the Cameron Group. You can reach me at go to my website, www.thecamerongroup.info. Go to the second page. I'm on the second page.
There you go.
So you'll know.
Yeah.
Also, give me a call, 484-274-8459. Follow me on Instagram at the Cameron Group. You can follow me on Facebook at the Cameron Group. I'm just a humble servant. I will tell you my one selfish reason. I have two little girls, and I want my girls to one day, you know, grow up, and I want them to meet a strong young man that they can depend on and build a strong family. So that is one my one selfish. And I have a 23-year-old that I'm building up to be a strong man. So, wow. That's my goal. No other goal. And I can say I stay in my lane and I'm looking forward to collaborate with you. We're going to do some things ASAP. So, give me a call, 484-274-8459. But please go to my website, which is thecamerongroup.info.
We'll make sure we also promote it as well. And Lance will put that out on the Facebook page. Helen, take it away.
I'm sorry, one more.
Sure. I would love it if you went to my website as well. And it's helenirwin.com. And Irwin is spelled with an E. So it's HELENERWIN.com. And there you'll find all the links to where you can buy James's Journey on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And also ebooks. I actually love to read ebooks. Yeah. So it's available as an iBook and Kindle as well. And you'll find it all on my website.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Bridget?
Okay. As you all know me on Facebook, it's your girl and I'm doing it. Everybody knows me by that hashtag. You can find my books on Amazon. It's called The Monologues of Poetic Mistress, or you can find ABC, They Look Like Me, which is an African American ABC learning history book. Also, we have the, Fatherless Child is going to be coming on, Community TV, Philly Cam, and we're also going to be in the awards.
Beautiful.
I'm coming up. So that's what we got going on. And a production called Prison to Home. So we're going to be shooting that production with our men in our community have been to prison and are back home now.
Awesome. Listen, I'm telling you guys, I have been tremendously empowered by this show. Three amazing individuals who are leading change in their own right. I encourage you. I need everybody who's listening. Pick up James's Journey. You have to add it to your collection. It is absolutely important. Pick it up today. You will not be disappointed. This is a book that gives perspective to a very critical conversation that we need to have, not just in our generations, but also in our culture. Make sure you pick up ABC, They Look Like Me, and Monologues of a Poetic Mistress. They're all on Amazon. Quite. Yeah, you could go to your Amazon account and pick up all of these books and have them shipped together in one pretty package. There's a book coming this summer. Make sure you pick that one up too. Jonathan's book, The Five Pillars of Leadership for Boys. That's a necessary book that Please. Must be in every Yes. barbershop.
Yes.
That we have in every mentor program. These are three amazing authors. I am honored to have each one of them spend time with us here at Heart of the City Radio. Helen, thank you so much for calling in and giving us your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Bridget, thank you so much for
thank
being here.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. John, thank you, brother,
thank you so
for
much,
being here
man.
And all the work you guys are doing. You've been listening to The Heart of the City, the show topic today, The Power of the Pen, Healing, Learning, and Loving through Literary Works. There's enough of those to go around right now. Take you out a couple dollars and go to Amazon and get those books. We'll make sure we also post them on the Facebook page. Lance will get it there. You can get the replay on our Facebook page, courtesy of Ed, our AV guy. Teresa's on PR and social media as always. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will see you next week. As always, you can catch us on Instagram, Heart City Radio, Facebook, Heart City Radio, and Twitter, Heart City Radio. And please, feel beautiful, look beautiful, and act beautiful. Why? Because you truly are beautiful. I'll see you next week.